You're listening to Three Stories of Justice and Injustice by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, October 14th, 2018, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
3 years ago, a mother and her two daughters left Kabul, Afghanistan, and traveled to the U.S. as visitors. Her intention was to claim refugee status in the U.S. and then bring her husband to join the family. Her husband belongs to the Hazara minority in Afghanistan, and aside from Kabul being dangerous, those who are Hazara are in special danger, having been the target of bombings in 2016 and 17. But when Mehta, I'm using a fictitious name, arrived in the U.S., her friends told her that it would be a long time before she would be able to sponsor her husband, and this was even before Trump. And they advised her to go to Canada and try there. This she did, I'm not sure how. She crossed into Canada and requested asylum for herself and her daughters. The government gave her financial assistance. She first lived in a shelter, but after a few months, she found a basement suite on the same block as where I live. A caring Catholic couple regularly rents their suite out at a low rent to refugees and immigrants. $750 is the social assistance allowance for rent for a family of three, so that is what they charged. Life was not that easy for Mehta. Because she crossed the border on her own, she did not have a group sponsoring her, as refugees at our church sponsors do. Despite that, Mehta was fortunate to experience ad hoc support from numerous people in the immediate and larger community, Christian and non-Christian, who rallied around this Muslim family. I am now pleased to describe some of these things. The older daughter registered at the local school, but the younger daughter, who was four, and a pretty lively four, was too young. In Kabul, she had been in school, so she wondered why she could not go to school here like her big sister. Plus, her mother needed a break. Someone on our block had a daughter who worked at a local preschool. Although the preschool had some space, it had decided to not take any more children because the year was coming to a close. It was about April. But they made an exception for this girl, and she was able to attend for free. Then in the fall, she went to kindergarten at the local school and had more facility in English than she would have had otherwise. Mehta eventually attended school herself to upgrade her education so as to qualify for getting into a training program. So she was not at home to take her children to and from school. A neighbor who had children in the same school offered to take the girls. The government's assistance included a single mattress and box springs that Mehta did not have room for in their small apartment, but she wanted to save it for an eventual move to a larger apartment. A neighbor stored this mattress for her. A neighbor woman tutored the older daughter. From a neighbor, a local music teacher found out that the older daughter liked to sing, and the music teacher gave her free voice lessons. The MCC refugee office at the Mennonite Church at 52nd Avenue has a staff person with a law degree, and he offered free advice to her about applying for the various things that were necessary, such as claiming refugee status, obtaining permanent residency, sponsoring her husband, obtaining medical coverage, and obtaining the child benefit. These applications are not that easy to do. Early on, Mehta also took ESL classes at that church, and the classes are free for refugees. Mehta also received advice at the Immigration Services Society of BC. She needed considerable money to make the application to sponsor her husband. Two people covered this cost for her. When Mehta went to her hearing for permanent residency, a woman offered to look at the after the girls. The refugee food bank at the Sherbrooke Mennonite Church provided a bag of weekly groceries. In addition, Mehta sometimes went to the Greater Vancouver Food Bank. The Salvation Army collects toys for Christmas and gives them out to families on social assistance. Someone drove Mehta to pick up these toys. And finally, some agency, probably the Salvation Army too, provided an August holiday for the family on the Sunshine Coast. The title for this one is Stolen Waters, Thirsty People. He could have gone to any of the 85 Indigenous communities in Canada that are currently under boil water advisories, but he chose to go to Shoal Lake 40 First Nations, or Kekakozibi Hawk River. This is the one that supplies the city of Winnipeg with water, the one where the city's aquifer cuts the community off from the mainland, the one that gives drink to 750,000 people, but whose own people go thirsty. So he took the small, slow barge from the mainland and arrived on the shore of the artificial island. Tired from his journey, he sat down by the community hall. It was about noon. A woman came to haul her water, the blue plastic jugs a heavy burden. And he said to her, "Could I have a drink?" His friends had gone to Kenora to buy food. She said to him, "How is it that you, an outsider, asked a drink of me, a member of this community? No one usually came to Shoal Lake to drink the water. I should be asking you for a drink of water," she joked. "If you asked me," he said, "I would give you living water." The woman said to him, "But you have no water jug. You have nothing to boil water in. Where would you get that living water?" He said to her, "You're right. Today, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of their own living water will never be thirsty. One day soon, living water will become in you a spring of pure, clean water, gushing up to sustain your children forever." The woman said, "I hope so. We've been longing and working for this water so that we may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to haul water." He said to her, "Go call your husband and come back." She answered, "I have no husband." He said to her, "You're right in saying that you have no husband. You lost him last winter when he fell through the ice, trying to cross to the mainland. This community has suffered too many years of broken promises ever since that aquifer was built 100 years ago from the disturbed bones of your ancestors." The woman looked at him for a while. Then she said to him, "I see you know about our history. We've been passed back and forth between levels of government for decades. No one wants to take responsibility for honoring the treaties. Our people say that this land and water are sacred, that this is where we meet Creator. But for the settlers, land and water are just resources to be bought and sold. That's what's sacred to them." He said to her, "Believe me, the hour is coming when the treaties will be honored, when settlers and indigenous people will bless each other, when the spirit of true reconciliation will no longer be a far-off dream, but will dwell among us. The hour is coming and is now here when Jews and Christians will remember what their sacred scriptures say. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." The woman said to him, "I know that our freedom road is coming, and once it's built, we'll no longer be cut off. We'll be able to clean our water and quench our thirst again." Jesus said to her, "I know what it's like to be thirsty. I'm the one who once said, 'Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled.' And I'm with you as you continue to work for justice, for the living water that will sustain your children and grandchildren forever." Now, there were some familiar elements in this story, I'm sure. It was written by Suzanne Gunther Lowen, and she grew up in Winnipeg, and drinking this water, and actually she said she was baptized with this water, and she's a Mennonite pastor and theologian, and she now lives in Saskatoon. And it's from the book Unsettling the Word, Biblical Experiments in Decolonization, edited by Steve Heinrichs, and every congregation received a copy. This is a story about Mary and Joseph, but not the Mary and Joseph in the Bible. Mary grew up in a small Lutheran village in eastern France, in a family which was the only Mennonite one in the village. When she was 15, she was baptized in the regional Mennonite church in the nearby city of Montbéliard. That was a pretty automatic practice in those days. When she was 20, it was time to get married. But instead, she got on a ship and immigrated to America. It is not obvious why she, the first one in her family to immigrate, did that. She was on the ship with an extended family of step relatives, but she did not settle where they did. She went to where she had first cousins living in Northwest Ohio in the Mennonite community there, which at that time was Amish. Some of these cousins had numerous small children, so perhaps she lived with them and helped out. When she was 28, she married Joseph, who was from the neighboring state of Indiana. He was her age and had also grown up in France, but was part of a different Mennonite congregation. His father was, in fact, a leader in the church. Joseph and an older brother were the first of their family to immigrate. Mary and Joseph had four living children, two sons and then two daughters. So far, so good. The Amish community practiced the teachings that it had brought over from France and Germany, but apparently there were some gaps. Into the community came a preacher from the Amish community in eastern Ohio, named John Holdeman. He was a reformer and sought to bring back some traditional practices that were lacking, among them excommunication and the shunning or avoidance of those excommunicated. As with many such reformers in the Anabaptist world, he ended up dividing the community and spawning a new denomination. It was called the Holdeman Church, or officially, the Church of God in Christ Mennonite. You can find it on the big chart in the hallway, along with the MB Church, which began the very next year, but on a different continent. John Holdeman traveled all around the U.S. and Midwest, and even into Canada, and the denomination still exists today, but it's fairly small. Mary's relatives took up with the teachings of John Holdeman, and Mary and Joseph joined the group too. However, and here is the problem, Joseph was an alcoholic. Remember those words of Kevin just read from 1 Corinthians. "By now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother or sister who is a drunkard. Do not even eat with such a one. Drive out the wicked person from among you." Eventually, Joseph was excommunicated. Mary must have been really conflicted. If she tried to be faithful to the new church's teachings by shunning her husband, it would not be much of a marriage. If she did not shun him, she too would probably be excommunicated and not eligible for heaven. Shunning meant not talking to him, not eating with him, and not sleeping with him. There was some back and forth working this out, but in the end, she continued to shun him. Obviously, this upset Joseph, and he ended up taking some drastic action. He divorced her, and he took the church leaders to court. The church leaders, being totally unfamiliar with courts, served as their own defense, and Joseph won his case. The situation was unusual enough that in 1878, the New York Times had an article, "Damage Against a Church. A Mennonite Obtains $2,500 for the Alienation of the Affections of His Wife." Remember those cousins that Mary may have lived with upon arriving in Ohio? Two of those were among the church leaders who were taken to court by Joseph. This situation obviously brings up a lot of questions. What would motivate these relatives to excommunicate their cousin's husband? Was it to keep the church pure? Did they think that excommunicating Joseph would cause him to reflect on his behavior and reform and stop drinking alcohol? Did they think that giving up alcohol was something one could easily choose to do? Did they excommunicate Joseph because they felt sorry for Mary and wanted a better life for her? What happened to the family? Joseph took the boys and Mary the girls. For a few years, Mary lived with a non-Mennonite family, probably as a maid, and one of her nearby neighbors was one of those church leaders. As her children grew to adulthood, she lived with them in Indiana and North Dakota and died at the age of 82. Joseph soon married again to a widow. Joseph and Mary's older son, Christian, went to live with Joseph's brother in Indiana. The second older son, also named Joseph, lived with Joseph and his new wife and her children from the previous marriage. When son Joseph was 18, he was on a boat with a friend near a dam for a mill. The boat went over the dam, and Joseph drowned. The father, Joseph, was distraught, and he began to sink more and more into alcoholism. His new wife had come into an inheritance, so she divorced him, using his alcoholism and his non-support of her and the marriage as the reasons. There is no evidence that he married again. Joseph died at age 59.